Hi, John.
Hey, Alex.
You know what I hate?
What?
The city and people of Philadelphia.
Oh, why now?
You know, same stuff. You know, kind of throwing batteries at SATA or whatever they did. Their history of, like, horrific racism. The time the police department bombed an entire black neighborhood. Oh, yeah, and, that's where Split takes place.
Equally as bad, I'm sure.
Yeah. I didn't hate this movie at all. I just, you know. We have a way to start the show, and, you know, I had to fit it in, so that's what we went with.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I didn't hate this. I saw this before years ago. And I wasn't as taken with it this time around, but it was still, it was a decent, decent is I think selling a short. I think it's a pretty good thriller, and I think it's nice to see M. Night Shyamalan do good things because he's good when he's good.
Yeah, it was surprising to me because I had given up on him many movies ago. I mean, I haven't even seen most of his recent ones.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Kind of like The Village era. I was like, I'm done. This is...
Yeah, I think I bailed after Signs. I don't think I've seen anything since Signs.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, wow, this is... You know, you forget that he's a good filmmaker. Like, the opening scene where they're coming back from the party and one of the personalities... kidnaps the girls. That whole scene of like Anya Taylor-Joy looking in the side view mirror and seeing like like that's like a tense kind of build up. I'm like, oh, this is good. Like, this is filmmaking. Oh, am I in for a solid movie? And it was very, you know, pleasantly surprising.
Yeah, it's also nice to see just like a regular old thriller. It's been a while since I've seen one of those. And although I do think one thing M. Night Shyamalan does pretty well is playing with genre a bit in terms of like, so you have, you know, like Unbreakable was the first act of a superhero movie made into a movie. You know, Signs was this alien invasion movie told from the point of view of a single family in the middle of Iowa or wherever. And this was like, what if it's, you know, I think there's a line in Adaptation where Nicolas Cage talking to the other Nicolas Cage is like, the only thing more tired than serial killers is split personalities and or multiple personalities. And he takes both of these kind of tired tropes, but actually does the thing without giving too much away just yet of like, hey, you know, in Manhunter or Red Dragon, where Francis Dollarhide, the killer, talks about how the murdering these people is going to change him. He's becoming. What if that actually happened?
Yeah.
And that was kind of a neat little twist on it. Even though I think this movie overall doesn't suffer from the M. Night Shyamalan twist thing as hard as some of his other ones do.
No, he didn't try to pull a swerve at the end, which was nice.
No, I think it kind of goes off the rails a bit in the third act, or I don't know, the third act, but like towards the end, but not necessarily in a completely bizarre way, or you know, completely unexpected.
It's not strong at the end. It doesn't end well, but it doesn't end in that M. Night stupid way, which,
yeah,
I mean, it's a bad thing to give credit for. It's like, hey, you didn't fuck it up the way you normally do, but I mean... Let's face it. You have to give the man credit.
Yeah, you didn't fuck it up the way you normally do. Yeah.
I have a few like pretty annoyances with the film, but the main one filmically, well, there's two main ones. I'll get to the other one later, but the opening credits are embarrassing where it splits and it's like a whole bunch of the same thing on the screen. Oh, that
see,
was,
see for me, I love it because it's simple. And it's, you know, yeah, it's absolutely on the nose.
Yeah.
But I think it's also, like, for the kind of movie this is, that's fine. You know what I mean? It's not trying to be anything more than it is.
I guess you're right, but it's so, so on the nose.
Yeah.
Well,
and how the end credits are, like, the end credits and then behind them are the end credits behind them. You know, like, there's the grid of end credits behind the end credits to keep that split thing going.
Oh, is that what happened? I don't think I watched the end credits.
Yeah.
I think I scrolled through to see if there was an after credits scene.
No, it's a similar effect to what you were just describing.
Yeah, just dumb. Yeah. Oh, here's the thing. This is actually what I was going to open the show with, and I forgot to. Is if you could design a movie that's less likely for me to be able to talk about articulately than this one, uh-huh. Congratulations. Because how the hell, as someone that forgets character names and only calls them, if I'm lucky, I remember the actor's names.
Uh-huh.
How the hell am I going to talk about this movie where, you know, so James McAvoy. No, the other James McAvoy. Yeah. No. When James McAvoy is James McAvoy.
Yeah, the lispy James McAvoy.
I tried to write down as many of the personality names as possible when I have to reference them. But mm-hmm. Jesus Christ, I'm like, oh, I'm fucked here.
Yeah, this is an affront to you specifically.
Oh, it's so. I mean, obviously my fault, but in this case, it's like extra fucking difficult.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so we open with Barry. Played by James McAvoy, kidnapping two kind of preppy popular girls and a kind of gothy outcast that happened to be with them.
Well, technically it's Dennis. See, already we've started.
No, I thought that was... No, that's Barry.
Barry's the fashion guy. Dennis is the super uptight.
Oh, no, that's who I meant. Yeah. Okay, fuck.
Because it's confusing because later Dennis pretends to be Barry.
That's exactly why I fucked it up. I think I have their names switched for the first half of the file. Yes. So Dennis is the kind of gruff guy, like the guy that knows how to do shit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he kidnaps him. And then what's her name? Anya Taylor-Joy? Is that
Anya Taylor-Joy. That is the actress.
Who very quickly becoming like the best actress ever. Like she's in like all sorts of good shit.
She is. I never saw The King's Gambit and I was a little nervous when I remembered her being in here. Cause man, I was tired of seeing her flipping face. Not her fault, but just like The King's Gambit was everywhere.
Oh yeah.
And so I was just tired of seeing it. And I'm like, oh man, this person again, but, she's great. I mean, she was great in The Witch and, I'd forgotten that she was in this and I think she's very good in this.
Yeah, Queen's Gambit is terrific. It's very well done. If there's 8 episodes, 7 are terrific. Mm-hmm. Like, not to say that there's one bad one, but it's like, it kind of suffers from that. I believe they chose how many episodes they wanted before they fully wrote them.
Yeah, like any like, Marvel series.
Yeah, we could have tightened this up. We could have tightened a full episode out of this, but I mean, it's really good. There's some good acting choices in there from her and some of the side characters are really good.
Nice.
But anyway, yeah, back to this movie. So yeah, they're kidnapped and she is set up as kind of damaged goth girl that seems to know a bit about what's going on, which doesn't 100% pay off. But I mean, not that that's a bad thing, but she notices that Dennis has OCD. So she tells one of the preppy girls to piss herself. So, you know, presumably doesn't get raped. I mean, that's I think where our thinking is supposed to go to open.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, they do a good job of she's this outcast that just gets invited to this party, this fellow student's party, basically out of pity. And then, gets kidnapped along with him. And the, and you as the audience, like you're already supposed to be sympathetic with her, at the beginning or sympathetic to her. But then as it progresses, she seems to like know stuff or is very kind of calm in the face of all this. That's kind of it's an interesting part because it's not someone who is like freaking out at the beginning and then like struggles and figures out. She's weirdly calm about this. So then you're kind of interested about what's her deal. Why, there's a mystery around her as well, which I think she does plays very effectively.
Yeah. I was so glad because the way she's introduced of her knowing what's up and since it is an M. Night movie,
mm-hmm.
I'm so glad they didn't go with the, she's actually got DID as well and whatever, you know, because that so would have been early career or mid-career M. Night. That's exactly what would have happened and I would have been very annoyed by it.
Yeah, there is a movie, I believe it's High Tension, this like French movie where like this woman is being stalked by a killer the whole time. Then at the end, it's revealed it's her. It's been her this whole time.
Oh, yeah.
Which is extremely stupid, but also, like, there's a scene where she's chased in a car by this person, so that doesn't make any sense. And wait, I believe so. This is just sort of what I've read about the movie, and if I'm getting the name of the movie right. But I was so worried it was going to be something like that too, you know, like that it was going to be some kind of ridiculous reveal to that extent.
Yeah, like what happens in Glass, which, well, I'm not going to talk about.
Yeah, though your hatred of it has made me a little bit more interested.
Glass isn't like a horrible movie, but it just goes back to everything he does wrong. And there's some, we can talk about it for this too, is there's some cinematography that is disgusting in it. Uh-huh. This one's got it too, where the camera movement, I think it's in this one, I watched them really close to each other, where it does that weird camera flips over the top of the frame move when it's following someone.
Uh-huh.
Which I just hate. It's so showing off. It's just, ugh. Yeah, it is in this one. I think they're following like the therapist outside. But mm-hmm. Yeah, I hate that kind of fancy move. It's just, it's nauseating.
I will say, I think in general, I think this movie is shot and put together very well. It's very effectively, just how gritty where he lives is and like just all the hallway shots and like the scene where he's dancing, I thought was very creepy. And I'm trying to remember the name of the, I'm trying to find one second. Who the
little kid is Hedwig.
No.
I know his name.
Who the cinematographer is.
Oh. Yeah, no, it mostly looks good. It's just a couple of those camera moves really bothered me.
Fancy stuff. I'm not going to be able to say this, I'm sure. Mike Giolakis, Giolakis.
Perfect.
He did the cinematography for Us and It Follows, which makes a lot of sense if you've seen both of those movies. It Follows and Split, I think, share a similar look in a lot of ways.
I haven't seen it, but I enjoy it. It's not
for everybody, but I dug it.
It's one of those movies that everybody was talking about how great it was, which just immediately made me not want to watch it.
See, most people I know really don't like it, but...
Oh, really? Oh, all I heard were people fucking just blowing that movie. We're set up to they're in this, you know, kind of dungeon area. And it's revealed. We don't show anything with the DID yet, right? We hear Dennis talk to Patricia through the door. But we don't know it's, you know, a multiple personality thing.
Yeah, all we've met is this person who we eventually learn is Dennis. But yeah.
So it's interesting setup. I think the advertising for the movie, and I mean, it's completely obvious that it's a split personality deal. So it's fine. I mean, I'm glad, you know, I guess, you know, watch the movie 10 years and you forget about the setup from the advertising, but mm-hmm. it's just weird to be like, oh, we're gonna leave the bait on the hook a little bit here, where it's we're well aware.
Yeah, well, I think in every site you can find it on or whatever, just tells you that's what it's about.
Yeah, totally.
Which is fine. I mean, I think it would be neat to go into it to have gone into it cold, but they really want you to know that's kind of the thing right out, but. I think one thing that really helped save this movie, as we get into the discussion of the DID, dissociative identity disorder, which I guess it took a lot of shit when it opened because of that, because, you know, people are like, you're making light of a serious mental health issue. You know, this is a tired trope that represents this community badly, and you're pretending that we are all, you know, have this predilection for violence. And I'm not going to discuss whether or not that's true, but I will say that I do think that this movie tries to at least explain the situation a little bit better in terms of his therapist that you meet, played by Betty Buckley, his therapist, Karen Fletcher, like her descriptions of this kind of stuff and that it is a serious illness and a real thing. And even the correct use of the term, the dissociative identity disorder, is at least a step in the right direction. And I don't want to like give the movie like, so it's fine, you know, any problematic element to it is wiped away. But I do think that was at least worth noting, although it does kind of become this more sci-fi fantastic-y thing, because her belief starts to be that they're better than people, you know, than regular
people. I mean, she believes they literally have superpowers. So the doctor is, and I think maybe, I don't know if everybody would pick it up on this, but it's from where I'm from, really trying to hit that Philly accent or trying to hide her Philly accent. Because every now and again, there are some Philly-ass vowels coming out of that lady.
I didn't notice that. I was more distracted by some of her, like, really tortured dialogue. When, and this is such a minor point, but the one scene with M. Night Shyamalan in it, who should stop being in his own movies. I like that he at least, like, reduced his role. But the whole little speech about the hot wings that he got her have this very, like, forced, almost, not, weedney isn't the right thing, but it's just this, like, I don't know, it felt very unnatural for that character and the tone of the movie in general.
Yeah.
It felt like something out of Reality Bites or something. I don't know.
No, there was an awkward scene. I totally forgot about that. He's got another awkward scene in class. That's what I was thinking of, which doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, that actress is pretty good. I mean, she does the job well. You know, it's a lot of dumb things to say, especially in a Skype call on a movie.
Right, yeah.
Which happens a little later, but yeah.
Sure, her job is like, hello, I'm Dr. Exposition. You know, I'm Dr. Backstory. But I do like the play between Kevin's personalities and her. That back and forth of whoever takes control of or is in the light, I believe is what they call it in the movie. Whichever is the dominant personality at that moment, like some will email the doctor, be like, hey, I got to see you right away. And then the other one will have to go there and be like, everything's fine. Don't worry about it. And I just like that as a concept that these people, that the horde, which is this group of the bad personalities, have to do this weird damage control for the other personalities. I thought that was a fun narrative wrinkle.
Yeah, I mean, I guess we can talk about it now. I don't think I understand the power dynamic going on here. Like, I mean, there's the Horde, which is a group of the personalities that gather together so they can control the light more frequently. But what does that have to do with the Beast?
So essentially, what you come to discover with what's going on inside of the James McAvoy's character is Kevin Wendell Crumb, and he's created all these other personalities for him. And there's 23 because the Beast is 24th. And according to them, basically all they just sit around in chairs in this dark room, and there's a light in the center of the room. And if you take the light, you are Kevin in that moment. Like that's when you are out in the world and no longer just exist in that room. Although within the room, these people exist and live some sort of lives in there or something, because the Horde, which is, I believe, is what they call the personalities of Dennis, Patricia, and Hedwig, the young child, they have this belief of an additional personality called the Beast, who is like the superhuman, can withstand being shot, can climb on walls, can eat people, and all this stuff. And all the other personalities are like, no, that's dumb. You're dangerous for trying to make this happen. So they try to shun them and lock them away. But Hedwig has some ability. And none of this is explained. And that's fine, because this is supposed to be strange and alien to you, the viewer. Hedwig somehow has the ability to take the light whenever he wants. And give that. And so as such, he can just give it to Dennis and Patricia. And they've manipulated him into being able to do so. And doing so, like, I don't know if they believe they can bring about the Beast, which is what it sort of sounded like, or just their belief that that could actually happen. And the other people didn't want, like, that was this huge, like, the darkest part of Kevin. And the other personalities were like, no, we need to keep that locked away. I know, because it does get definitely, like, more sci-fi-y in that regard. But I do like that there is this whole behind-the-scenes struggle that you never... you get told about, but that you don't see, and that he didn't try to represent it. There wasn't a room full of James McAvoy's yelling at each other.
Yeah, not that Malkovich scene. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, that's exactly what I would have thought.
Yeah.
And I don't know if we've talked about it enough, just how great James McAvoy is in this.
Oh yeah. He is absolutely terrific in what could have been a very embarrassing role.
Yeah. This could have fallen apart in lesser hands. And apparently Joaquin Phoenix was supposed to be the guy at one point, which would have been very interesting. I would have liked to have seen that. Although I've of course in my head I'm just thinking about they're all just different versions of Arthur Fleck from the Joker. But I do think that like he does kind of chew up the scenery in some places, but I think it's good that he does. I think he's kind of supposed to.
Yeah, because there's a couple of the roles that I think, like, all right, so one, Hedwig, the 9-year-old,
mm-hmm.
could be super cringy if done. He pulled that off as best as you can.
Yeah.
It comes across kind of creepy, which you need, you know.
Yeah.
But the other ones is he didn't, when he plays Patricia, I think it's, well, no, there's another female in there too, but like the main female we meet.
Yeah, that would be Patricia's, the main one we deal with.
Yeah, yeah. So Patricia isn't, I don't even know how to word this. It should have been worse. Mm-hmm. It's like this really razor thin line that he's walking and he really, really pulls it off well.
Yeah. I think something to the film's credit is that they didn't, although each of these personalities are generally represented by the clothes that they are wearing. And in there's a couple of situations where like, wait, you just left the room to go put on a shirt. To come back as this guy that seems a little bit silly, but that Patricia is like, they don't bother to like, well, and then he puts on a wig and then he puts on his makeup and earrings, that it is still just James McAvoy, but he's got a necklace on and earrings and is like a particular like dress. And, I don't know. I think that really worked for me just of being like, well, this is an aspect of this person. This Kevin person, and it's not, I feel like it would have gone too far if they like dulled up Patricia too much, if that makes any sense.
No, absolutely. That's one of the many ways it could have gone sideways.
Yeah.
Like the Hedwig stuff that he's not dressed as he doesn't have like a Wally Pop.
Exactly. His little sailor suit.
He dresses like some fucking annoying 9-year-old that's just discovering music. It's a tightrope and he walks it well. Not that I keep going back to Glass, but like he doesn't do it as well in that movie.
And
it's kind of embarrassing, which is why I know it could go wrong.
Well, the reason we keep bringing up Glass is because this is a sequel to Unbreakable, which you don't know until the absolute final shot, which I guess he didn't, Shyamalan like kept out of initial test screenings. He didn't really, until they showed it at Fantastic Fest, he kept it out of there. And it's very much like, oh, okay. I guess it's part of this now.
Well, I mean, but also Glass is the sequel to this movie. Like,
Yes. There's that as well.
It's 90% a sequel.
Yeah.
It's also kind of a sequel to Unbreakable, but it's more a sequel to this, and it's worse in every way.
Oh, that sucks. I've been hesitant to go back and check out Unbreakable because I really liked Unbreakable, but that was also back when it was like, oh my God, a joyless, serious superhero movie? How crazy.
I've had that same thought because I really enjoyed that movie back then, but now so much superhero stuff has happened since then that it's wow, a superhero origin story in a movie. I remember thinking how novel that is, and now there's 40 of those.
Yeah. So I don't know. But I bet it's, you know, I can think of several things right now that I still like about it that are, you know, individual scenes or bits and whatever. So I'm sure I'll go check it out at some point.
Yeah. I have a line here. I don't have many lines of dialogue quoted, which I tend to do because the dialogue's not exactly crackling, but you know, it's not terrible. But I think it's Patricia at some point says, I've heard that Asian people's music aids digestion.
Yes.
And that line just really made me laugh.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're talking to these three children that you've kidnapped.
Yeah.
We're making them sandwiches.
But she's being all very, very polite and very sweet. I like the different interactions with the personalities with the girls. Like, Dennis is very much the hammer. Like, you know, when you need to punish someone or, you know, get the job done, you call Dennis. But Patricia, although seemingly like perhaps the mastermind of this whole thing, is still very nice to them and very sweet.
Yeah. Not to belabor it. I think it's maybe I'm just being stupid, but, or the movie's, no, I'm going to blame the movie. Forget it.
Go for it.
Back. I just don't see the point. So Dennis has said he doesn't really like the whole killing stuff. And towards the end, he like full out admits that he doesn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Patricia doesn't seem all that fond of it. I guess I just don't see why they're on Team Beast. Something just doesn't like make sense. I mean, also we're dealing with someone that's, you know, psychotic. So
right.
Maybe I'm just trying to overthink something here.
Yeah. I think it's more just the potential of the Beast, like this is what we can become. This is what we can bring about. This powerful being, and that this is, you know, you could make perhaps an argument that it's like, this is going to be the true nature of Kevin, or something. But, yeah. It is just that we can be more than we are. Because, I mean, like, they obviously, since they're sitting around in a room and can only get the light, they have some awareness of being part of a collective and not like a human being, you know what I mean? Or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
That this beast could be a uniting force, or that, you know, if they can get it up so that they can help control the beast, they can do what they whatever they want to do. Because they seem pretty excited at the end when the beast has arrived.
I mean, I'd be pretty excited too. Like, I mean, I don't have those kind of abs, and like, he's got some swole ass triceps. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, he's looking good. So yeah, I'd be. I mean, so what? You have to murder a couple cheerleaders, you know? No pain, no gain.
Exactly. That's if you see Pumping Iron, the director's cut, there's a lot of scenes in there of Arnold Schwarzenegger murdering cheerleaders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so, hilarious. I mean, and then he starts breaking up like Smokey and the Bandit outtakes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah. And so we're just kind of building the story of the three girls trying to get out. They find like an escape hatch hidden in the ceiling, and Eyebrows. I don't know either of their names, but Eyebrows tries to get out through the ceiling, and it's very tense kind of thriller scene that doesn't really do anything to the plot, because this is where, like, I like the setup. I like when James McAvoy has to do stuff and talk to people, but anything with the girls when they have to do like the stuff that you need to do to make it a movie, I'm just kind of like, not checking out, but I'm just
right. I think those things, because you need to have some sort of action happen, I guess. And the try to escape scenes were very interesting, and I also really liked the you get these flashbacks occasionally to young Casey, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, like going hunting with her dad and Uncle John.
That's right. Yeah.
And how those play out. And I don't know how you want to just talk about those
we might as well just give that. Because it's kind of hard to circle back.
Because you have this thing where you find that she's okay. Well, maybe she knows this kind of stuff because she, you know. Her and her dad went hunting all the time, and like, so she's used to trying to, I don't know, stay calm in situations when dealing with a animal that's more powerful than herself or something. But then you start to figure out that they just tell you on one of these trips or on several of these trips, her Uncle John, like her dad is, she's separated from her dad, and her Uncle John is like, hey, let's play the game where we're animals. And she goes around the corner and he's nude. And he's like, come on, take off your clothes. Animals, we don't wear clothes. And they don't go into it much more than that. They leave it up to you, the viewer, to fill in the awful, awful stuff. And at one point she, and a very young, like she's like five or something like that in the movie. She's very young. Like, pulls a gun on Uncle John and can't pull the trigger. And it's like the slow reveal of this stuff. And that's why this character is so separate from everyone else. Like why she's like gets in trouble and, is such an outcast, that why she seems so distant and strange. And for like this sort of like, like the parallel tracks of the two main characters and their traumas, I thought was interesting.
Yeah. I don't want to like go too far into it, but it's another one of those kind of, dealing with mental health issues in a, I could definitely see this being problematic, I guess, yes, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is basically you're saying, well, sometimes you get molested as a child and you come out great and you can, yeah, fight back against your, the people that are attacking you. But then sometimes you get hurt as a child and you turn into a serial killer. I mean, I guess that's the way it works.
I see what you're saying, but I don't know that it's necessarily that because like she has like, you find out later, is like cutting herself and scarred up that she has not like gotten better, that, you know, she's not moved on past this, particularly because you find out later that her dad has died and she lives with this Uncle John guy now.
Yeah.
And that, you know, who knows what's still going on there, but that things aren't great for her. And I think when you get to the end and she has to stand up to the beast, I don't even think it's like it's a triumphant moment there either. Which is something that kind of gets a little bit, if we get more in the last act, we can talk about how the movie kind of goes off the rails there. And that was a little bit unsatisfying for me, their final confrontation, but
yeah. Well, on the camping trip note, here's another, I mean, I guess the balls on the uncle is your brother's like in a tent, like a few yards away.
Yeah.
I mean, how horny are you?
Yeah.
this is like an absurd situation. I get like, you know, maybe you, whatever. I'm not trying to give like hints on how to properly molest a child, but I'm just saying that's fucking bad.
That's my other podcast.
Yeah, yeah. Alex hates
parental supervision.
Yeah, thank you. I was trying to find some way to say that everything it came out with was hideous. And like, well, yeah, nope, not say that.
No, this is way better. Yeah, you want to be classy when you're talking about this.
Yeah, there was an interesting thing too, because it leads to that scene where she pulls the gun on him.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense. There's just kind of, it's a weird, again, this movie kind of making strange decisions, is you would think, oh, well, she would kill him, obviously, because that's, you know, that's why she's messed up and in the foster care system. But no, just, yeah, it's a, anyway, doesn't matter. Just weird choice. Good choice, maybe? I don't know.
You decide, audience.
Yeah, just put on some Asian music, help your digestion, and think about it.
But I do like, cause I think, that helped break things up nicely. Cause there's not that many escape attempts. Cause I don't know if I would have enjoyed watching a whole bunch of failed escape attempts, which is basically just the Saw movies. And I don't enjoy those.
So they break out through the ceiling. And then, the other girl tries to run away at one point,
mm-hmm,
and then gets separated. And then, Casey's only real attempts were trying to trick Hedwig into letting her to leave.
Right. Because Hedwig is talking about how he likes music and he listens to the stereo by his window. And she's like, oh, by a window, huh? I would love to watch you dance. And the window ends up being a drawing that he put up by a stereo. And then, yeah, he makes her watch him dance. And it is like, it's goofy and kind of funny, but it's also terrifying, like, yes, watching him do this. And I thought that was really effectively done.
The first time Hedwig walks in the room is genuinely scary, if you have any kind of empathy for the girls, because she's like, what the fuck is happening right now?
Yeah.
There's an interesting thing, too. forget it. I'm going to say it. Technically, she molests Hedwig.
Yeah,
I mean, she does let a nine-year-old boy kiss her.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, you know, it's cyclical trauma and all, but, you know, got to fight back against that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know if you could go to jail for that or not.
What I said? I hope so. Because it's disgusting, but I thought it'd be kind of edgelordy and maybe we'd get people to respond. I just want someone to talk to me, Josh.
Please. Look, how many nine-year-olds do I have to kiss before someone will talk to me?
Well, I can tell you five ain't enough. that dancing the room thing. And then there's that really frustrating scene, which I thought was, I mean, frustrating for a good reason, where she gets the walkie-talkie from Hedwig,
mm-hmm,
and ends up talking to one of the security guards upstairs.
Yeah.
Who's
convinced it's just a joke.
Yeah, which was so frustrating. It was fun, like, great, well done. And I like that they pay it off later.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, I'm just putting on my orange headphones. Like, you know, it didn't even occur to me of like, why did he point that out? But it's later where you see this dude with the orange headphones. You're like, oh, fuck, that's the asshole.
That's that guy. What a dick. Yeah.
But to be fair, it was only like a day later. So it's not like he would have saved that much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, because you have no idea where these people are being held. You do have this idea through his Kevin's interactions with his psychologist that he has a job and it's going well. Like that's all you know. You don't know where he works, but that it seems to be doing okay. And during these, she's generally talking to the character of to the personality as Barry, who. Is like a wants to be a fashion designer, but then it's eventually revealed that it's Dennis pretending to be Barry, and they figure that out because Barry keeps like adjusting positions of candy dishes and just being generally fussy in ways that Barry normally isn't, and that's just like that's a whole wild thing I don't think I've ever seen in you know there's such a myriad of these you know multiple personality movies I don't think I've ever seen one where a personality was pretending to be a different personality.
But yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I've ever seen that either.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to say, I mean, it could very well, I want to say the most likely candidate for that would be De Palma's Raising Kane, but I haven't seen that so in years, so I have no idea. But that just seems like a very Brian De Palma ridiculous thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, make it a vampire movie and then based on a PlayStation game. Interesting.
Yes, that is what I was talking about.
Blah, blah, blah. We talked about the other kind of therapy moment. So she susses out that it's actually Barry.
Mm-hmm. Or Dennis. And,
Barry's actually Dennis. God damn it.
Yeah.
Those were the two I was going to try to remember and I still fuck it. But, that was a nice reveal of him where he drops the guys and he's like, starts talking to her. She's like, oh, it's an honor to meet you.
Mm-hmm.
Which it just leads to even more kind of serious, what am I saying? Like how dark it gets when she goes to visit him at work, you know?
Yes. Yeah.
Where she's, yeah. It's like, oh, hey, look, I had this major breakthrough. Everything's coming out well. I'm worried about them, but at least we have a dialogue going. And she shows up and it's like, oh shit, there's kidnapped children here. And now he thinks that he's an animal that could climb on walls and is going to eat me. It's a nice kind of swerve.
Yeah. Because particularly as we get into this final act, when she gets there and discovers that that Dennis, I think she maybe just thinks it's Dennis because Dennis has apparently issues with watching teenage girls dance. I don't know if it's something he's gotten in trouble for before, but it's something that she knows about anyway. And they tease this concept of the like differing physical nature of these different sort of entities that like one of them is diabetic, but none of the other ones are. Like one of them actually requires insulin shots and the other ones don't. And in this other speech that the therapist gives to some colleagues or something talks about a different situation where a similar thing where there's just like, well, there's like legitimate physical differences in or, you know, chemical differences.
Yeah, I think you're saying one was blind, but one of the personalities was fully sighted.
Yeah. Yeah. Just stuff like that. And so, and you eventually when, eventually like they get enough control, the horde or whatever gets enough control and pacifies the doctor, I believe. Just, I don't know if he knocks her out or straight. Well, she doesn't die because she writes the note, but she fucks her up pretty bad and then leaves to go to the train station where they're going to meet the beast, which gets a little silly for me because basically they meet the beast by Dennis goes onto a train, takes off his shirt and yells.
Yes.
And that's it is the beast.
It's pretty big letdown that we finally, like, I think the beast thing is kind of cool at parts, but like that is not the way you should have introduced it.
It was very strange. Yeah. He shows up with flowers because that was the thing and then gets onto this empty dark train car, which, cause since you don't know where he works, I'm like, oh, does he work at the train yard? Is that why no one cares that he's getting on this empty train by himself and it's dark and no one else is getting on this train. And then he just takes his shirt off and yells.
Yeah.
But yeah, then he's like screaming and then climbs up onto the top of the train and runs out into night.
Yeah, what he does is he goes back home. I mean, I guess it's not a big reveal. They're at a zoo. They're underneath the Philly Zoo. But like, so from a this is one person perspective, they went to the train station and then immediately returned home.
Mm-hmm. Like, yeah.
But I did like during this, they're interspersing with cuts to one of the two kidnapped girls that isn't Anya Taylor-Joy trying to escape using a coat hanger over the top of the door and trying to get the latch to go. Nice tension building. I was like, kind of, I found myself like white knuckling, like watching her attempt this.
This movie is very good at that, I think. And like I said, it's a pretty effective thriller. I think he's able to handle that tension really, really well. And when the beast finally arrives back home, I think Anya Taylor-Joy, like they get out, but Anya Taylor-Joy encounters the beast, like eating the other girl, basically.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And I don't remember if that happens before her run-in with actual Kevin or if that's after.
That's after. So he kills the doctor. He crunches her.
That's it. Yeah, that's his move. That's right. Because he hugs her, the old hug.
Yeah, but she's written down, say his name,
Kevin Wendell Crumb. Yeah.
I kept wanting to say Oliver Wendell Holmes. So Kevin Wendell Crumb. Casey finds that note. And we get a whole, we forgot. We skipped the whole, well, not skipped, but like one of the main things of the beast is he loves soliloquying. So he does like, the broken are the more evolved. Rejoice for the beast has come. It's like this really shitty sermon. It's cringe.
I mean, it's the serial killer, like I am becoming thing. And yeah, when he comes into the house or wherever it is that he's living, he like immediately just like crawls up the wall and back down. Ta-da! Look what I can do.
Yeah. I mean, it did look cool, but it didn't really have anything to do with anything.
It's creepy, but again, like I think the movie's effective in that it made it seem creepy when in reality he just like was like, check this out. Flip, 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 flip. Ha!
Yeah.
I'm the beast.
I did it.
I'm
Dr. Hank McCoy, a.k.a. the beast.
The beast.
So yeah, he gives a speech and that's, yeah, so Casey finds him and I think... Oh yeah, so he locks her in a cage. She locks herself in a cage.
Well, the conversation with Kevin is before the cage, because she says his name, and he like and is like, this was a little like Rumpelstiltskin-y, but like he's like, oh no, and kind of runs away, and eventually like comes in as Kevin.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's what happens, and then the Horde retakes control.
Yeah, because when he comes in as Kevin, he's like, it's still 2007, right? You know, because he's like, what's going on? Who are you? Why are you in my house? And he kind of figures out like, oh my God, I've been doing horrible things again. This has happened before. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, here's where my gun is. Please shoot me.
Yeah. I forgot about this whole section. Yeah. And yeah, so she grabs the gun. The beast retakes over the body, basically.
Mm-hmm.
There's the whole chase sequence. She shoots him. He's somewhat bulletproof.
Yeah, he can take a shot.
What? I don't even remember how it resolved. Does he just run away?
Kind of. So his whole thing is that like these with these women that he's kidnapped or whatever is that like in his mind they have not suffered anything. Like they don't know they are babes in the woods, and it's like it's his job to show people the way that life really is. And so like that these people have had nothing to worry about at all. And he starts chasing after, like, she gets the gun and he turns back into the beast. And I thought that Kevin scene was actually pretty good. I thought again, like, McAvoy, something that was kind of silly, McAvoy helped really elevate that into something that I actually, like, felt bad for that guy. But so he's chasing her in a very tense scene that she's, has run down this hallway. She's tried to escape down this hallway that ends, like, with a cage. She gets into the cage and she's like pointing the gun down the hallway and he's crawling on the ceiling and like starts knocking out all the lights so she can't see him to shoot him, which I thought was very, very creepy. But she gets in the cage and he comes at the cage. She shoots him a couple of times. He just sort of, almost like, you know, fighting one of the big guys in Resident Evil or something like that. Like, he reacts, but then he's still coming at her, and he's not that much damage has been done. And he starts pulling away, like starts bending the bars to try to get in there, but then figures out that she, like as she's crawling away on her back, like her shirt gets pulled up a bit and he sees all the scars on her and is like, ah, you've been hurt too. Cool. Bye. I mean, there's more to it than that, but that's basically what happens. He's like,
no,
oh,
you're right. Yeah.
I see that you aren't as pure as I thought you were. Ha ha. So you're one of us. You're just like me. And then leaves. At that point, like it's because it's been, you know, however many days, like as you find out, it's the zoo that is now back in operation and a fellow coworker like finds her in the cage and is like, what's going on here?
Yeah. So they sneak her out. Cops show up. We see that idiot that didn't listen to the walkie talkie.
Mm-hmm.
And then,
which again, I thought was a little tell, like a little throwback again to Manhunter. Red Dragon was that they're underneath like the tiger cage and he's made a couple of references or Patricia has made a couple of references to tigers, in previous scenes, but there's the whole thing in Manhunter where Francis Dolarhyde takes his blind girlfriend to go pet a tiger while it's under sedation. And he sees himself as the tiger. And so I thought that was a little nod to that. Manhunter being a better movie.
I think you're confused with Rocky, where he takes Adrian to the zoo. I think he calls himself retarded.
Oh, is that what he does?
Or no, maybe he calls her retarded.
He's like, hey, how are you enjoying the zoo? I'm retarded.
I think he calls her that. He's like, hey, you're a little slow. You're a little touched or something like that. It's I forget what the actual, I haven't seen that movie in ages, but I remember it's like, oh, this is terrible. Anyway, yeah, Philadelphia, great city. Yeah, so they get out and, you know, the end, except cut to the inside of a diner.
But before we get to the diner thing, though, I do like that. So she, you know, is whisked away to a cop car. The cops have sworn this. She's sitting in the back of the cop car. And you do get a little cut away of the horde, wherever they're at now, being like, oh, my God, that worked. Like, look at these, the different personalities reacting to, like, I got shot and I'm still alive. And like Hedwig being like, oh my God, this is so awesome. Which is absolutely what a 9-year-old would do. And I think that's great. But that when she's in the back of the car, a cop's just like, hey, your guardian is here to come get you. And you know, it's Uncle John. And she just stares at the cop. And I like how they don't tell you what happens. They don't go.
Oh, yeah.
And then she goes, she builds up the strength to be like, no, this guy's been assaulting me. Although you feel like maybe she's a little bit better equipped for this. Because this is what I was getting at earlier, is that I don't think she's ever overcome this. Because she's still in the situation where, this horrible abuse situation. She gets put in the situation with this serial killing monster. And yeah, she's able to pull the trigger on him, which she didn't do to her abuser in the past, Uncle John in the past, but it didn't matter because it didn't affect him at all. So what she left with, you know, like all the only thing that saved her was the fact that she got abused and wore scars of that.
Yeah.
So it was an interesting, like, I don't necessarily feel like this is a knock at the movie where I'm like, well, this character didn't grow or whatever, but I think it's a very interesting question of like, where is this person now? Like, where are they at? What are they left with after all of this?
Yeah.
That did this actually change them or did they just get saved to go be put back in this other awful situation?
Well, and these are good questions and they're all answered in the sequel Glass.
Are you serious?
In a way that is very unsatisfying.
Okay, yeah, yes. Do not tell me because I like the way this ends here.
Yeah. All
I kind of figured, but I didn't want to know.
All the good things about this movie, Glass kind of turns around and The problem with Glass is, like, if you just saw it by itself, it would be a lot better. But following this up, he's like, oh, man, this really blows.
Yeah. Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Did he at least in Glass, did he try to tie in the Evil Plant movie, The Happening?
No.
Ah, that's too bad. That would have been, he should have just gone for it. I mean, like, I'm tying this up. I'm making a whole M. Night U expanded universe. Honestly,
there may have been a reference, but as the obvious ones are just Unbreakable, Split, and Glass, or the three-part trilogy.
Yeah. I have never seen The Happening. I don't know that I want to.
It's really bad. Yeah. The Happening is tremendously bad. It is a so bad it's good, but I mean, there's a lot better so bads it's good out there.
It's one of those that I think I missed the window of people getting together and watching it and laughing. And so, you know, it'd be like joining your friends that are already drunk. You've all done this already. I'm just getting here. I would want to watch it cold with people who'd never seen it before, so we could all experience it together.
Well, you know, everybody write in at Jaws Pod, you know, so you can watch the movie with John.
Yeah, maybe we can do a watch along. I don't know if it's on Amazon Prime, we could Twitch stream it or something, but
I'm sure it is. That's the end. Then we go to the diner.
Mm-hmm.
And this is some of the worst dialogue that's ever happened.
Yeah.
This lady's watching TV about the coverage of what happened with Mr. Beast. And she's like, oh, this reminded me of 15 years ago where that one guy, you know, he had all that bad stuff happen. What was his name? And then we see Bruce Willis sitting there and he goes, Mr. Glass.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is brutal.
Yeah. It feels so tacked on. And they
shoot Bruce Willis from he's 90% like turkey waddle, like, you know, that neck waddle.
Yeah, he's aged.
And which is fine. He's 60 or whatever. Like he looks great for his age.
Right.
It's just the shot of the guy that was the hero that you're reintroducing. It's just, you have to choose a more flattering angle. It's just an awkward, awkward choice.
That's part of the thing with Unbreakable is that he is supposed to be just this, you know, sad everyman who also is invincible. But when you make him physically sad,
yeah,
I don't know. He doesn't seem like an everyday guy. He seems like an older everyday guy. Yeah.
So, but
there was, I wish I would have written it down. Otherwise, this is a pointless point to make without it, but there was something in the news report too, that was like, that's not a thing you would ever report on in the news, or like, that's information you wouldn't have. And I think it might've even been about how like the Horde or something like that, where it just felt very much like you're just explaining the plot. Why would you have this information like an hour later after? I don't know. It's a bad point, but it just seemed like this very like, yeah, we just saw the movie. Why are you just telling us this?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, everything needs to be self-contained. So that scene can be in the preview for Glass.
That's true. Everything leads to Glass.
So that's Split.
Yeah. I mean, I would honestly, if you're just looking for a thriller, I'd recommend it. You could absolutely do better, but I think it's not a bad movie at all.
It's totally watchable. I probably would watch it again, but like I wouldn't pay attention to it as much. Uh-huh. Like this is a perfect just let it be there kind of movie. Maybe check your phone every now and again. Like, because if you stare too hard, it doesn't, you know, the cracks start to appear.
Yeah. But I think for this genre of this problematic genre of filmmaking, I think you can do a lot worse.
Yeah.
But if you're dying to watch a dissociative identity disorder movie, this ain't bad.
Yes. So John, sometimes we watch things that are good,
mm-hmm.
and then we tell the audience about it. You seen anything good lately?
I have. I've been on a bit of a crime movie kick. I rewatched the David Mamet film Heist with Gene Hackman, which I loved even more this time than the last time I saw it. Gene Hackman, Delroy Lindo, Sam Rockwell, Danny DeVito. It's great. I mean, David Mamet has this very kind of particular style of dialogue, and I think his movies never escape his theatery trappings, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but I certainly enjoy that. And then I watched The Long Good Friday, excellent British crime gangster movie with Bob Hoskins about a mobster who's trying to like almost try to go straight, going to build this huge casino, and then all these things start going wrong and someone's out to get him. And why is that?
Oh, is it King Koopa?
It's, you wish. I'll say that much. I don't want to spoil too much, but
okay.
And it just Bob Hoskins is so great, and I realize I have not seen enough with him in it because what I've seen is like the Super Mario Brothers movie, but
yeah, I've only seen his garbage movies too.
But he's absolutely fantastic, and Helen Mirren's in it too. But young Pierce Brosnan is in a couple of scenes, but absolutely worth checking out, I'd say.
Excellent. I on a very kind of similar to David Mamet note. I watched the comic book vampire movie Priest.
Oh, with Paul Bettany.
Paul Bettany, yes.
Paul Bettany.
That's why I watched it, because we did a Knight's Tale, and I was like, I wonder what Paul Bettany movies I haven't seen. And I like a vampire movie, I like a comic book movie. It's a weird, so it's made in like 2006-ish,
mm-hmm.
but it's from 1999 somehow.
Yeah.
It's the aesthetics are so Matrix-y, and it's not a good movie. Like this shouldn't be in the recommendation section, but I'm kind of recommended watching it just cause it's just a weird example. It's so odd. Also Carl Urban is in it. And he's having a very good time. So he's fun to watch. He doesn't have enough screen time.
Nice. But, I always like that guy.
Yeah. He's doing a good job in this. It's amusing. It's one of those movies that feels like, so it's like, you know, if it's an hour and a half, I feel like the original cut was like 2:15 because it's like equally long, but also there's not enough in it. It's mm-hmm. it's just, but there's some like, it's a priest that fights vampires, which is already hilarious, but he's got like a priest mobile. Like he's got like a motorcycle that's kind of Akira looking, not Akira looking, mm-hmm. but it's wacky future motorcycle. It's
of course,
yeah. Everything about it is just, I don't want to give like specifics away because it kind of just, if you're ever bored, it's on Amazon Prime and you're just like, I just want to blow an hour or whatever. It's a very odd example of something like this. We didn't really know what superhero movies were yet. We didn't, you know, kind of the vampire things hasn't fully played out. So it's just this, yeah, it's,
well, that's always something that I've wanted to do. Either like we could do this over a series of episodes, or just an episode where we're talking about a bunch of different movies. But like the fallout of giant movies, like, you know, all the Quentin Tarantino ripoffs and like all the weird Matrix ripoffs, or you know, things that heavily influenced like that. Like, because this is clearly trying to be also like Underworld, which was like, what if the Matrix also had werewolves? Although technically, Matrix Reloaded was what if Matrix had werewolves. But, you know, that kind of sleek, leathery trench coat style. But yeah, if it's got Carl Urban, I totally see it.
Yeah. Yeah. And,
well, also, I mean, I'm such a fan. I have one of those, that line of detectors he sold to make sure there's not a colorless, odorless, tasteless gas in your house, a Carl Urban monoxide detector.
Oh, you know what I forgot to tell the audience is how this is our last episode ever. So
you're just mad that I took your gimmick of telling the worst puns possible.
I mean, that is an Alex level garbage fire you just shat out there.
Yep.
And well done. I'm both proud of you and very, very upset.
You're very welcome. All for you, baby.
So, John, for next episode, I was thinking we should probably watch... if you have any ideas on this, I was thinking like maybe like an American neo-noir thriller.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
Like maybe one that's written and directed by Dan Gilroy.
Oh, ugh.
How about one that stars Jake Gyllenhaal as Louis Lou Bloom?
Hmm. Well, there's a couple of options.
Mm-hmm.
There's a Super Mario Brothers movie or Nightcrawler.
Yeah, I just watched the Super Mario Brothers movie. So, yeah, why don't we do Nightcrawler?
Yeah, I think I think I'd prefer that one as well.
Yeah, because, you know, it's not the Super Mario Brothers movie.
Right, right.
Cool. That sounds perfect. All right, yeah, so we're watching the 2014 movie starring Jake Gyllenhaal. I think it's on Netflix. Either way, it's available on the internet.
Yes.
Yeah, so we'll do that.
Yeah.
And then you guys should follow us on Twitter, at JawsPod. Or on Facebook, John Alex Hates Stuff.
Yeah, reach out, say hello, suggest some movies to watch for us to watch, or just for you to watch.
Yes,
please write us, suggest let things. Us know what you think you should watch.
Yes, lots of suggestions. Suggestions are good. Please demand things of us. We have no spine. We'll probably do it.
Yep.
All right, cool. See you next time.
All right, goodbye.
Bye.